from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Next on Forum this morning, when Peter Orner saw a man at his local coffee shop poring over a book, the short story writer wondered if the man was nearsighted or loved the little book so much he wanted to get as close as possible to the words. Orner joins us to talk about his own love of words and his new short story collection, Last Car Over the Sagamore Bridge. A Guggenheim Fellow and Associate Creative Writing Professor at San Francisco State, he'll discuss with us the power of memory and his focus on human rights law and why reading Howard's End makes him think about gentrification in Bernal Hill. That's all coming up after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of this morning's Forum program. Chicago native and Bay Area resident Peter Orner is an associate professor of creative writing at San Francisco State, as well as a Guggenheim Fellowship recipient and an award-winning writer, author of Esther Stories, The Second Coming of Mavala Shikongo, and Love and Shame and Love, which we spoke about on Forum. His newest collection of fiction, which includes stories published in the Paris Review, Granta, McSweeney's, and A Public Space, is titled The Last Car Over the Sagamore Bridge, and he joins us for this Forum Hour. Good to have you back on Forum.
Oh, great to be back.
Welcome. Well, you know, a lot of the same themes, if you will, just to begin our discussion here, come up again in this collection. Families and politics, families who are drugged by politics, I think is the language, or it gets in their blood system so much. But so much else beyond that, divorces, deaths, family relations. I mean, this is your territory. But I started thinking about what is Peter Orner's territory. It's easy with motifs, but it's tougher with geography because you're all over the place here. I mean, and I'm wondering about that. There's a story in Spokane, for example. There's a story in Lincoln, Nebraska. There's a story in Dubrovnik, Moscow, different cities in Illinois, different cities in Massachusetts, Iowa, Kentucky. Why are we all over the map here?
I think it's the geography of my head in some ways. And it's also the fact that I tend to be a roamer. And I tend to, when I do roam around, I'm always collecting stories. And I like to ground stories in place. So if something attracts me about a particular place and a story kind of triggers there, then I'll ground it there and that'll help me imagine further.
Some of these stories are what you would call conventional plotted stories. Some of them are more what some would call metafiction or speed stories, maybe even more like poetry than stories. Again, it's what moves you?
Yeah, and in terms of what is a story is a question I'm always asking myself and always wondering. I mean, people have different names for stories that tend to not be so long sometimes, and I tend to just call them stories because I feel like I'm constantly trying to find out what constitutes a story. Is it, you know, sometimes to me a story could be a gesture that I remember over many years or you know, a glimpse of something I saw out of a train window as the train was moving. That's often, for me, that's a story, something that I saw just a tiny bit of and then it got gone forever.
Some would tie that more grammatical to poetry than to storytelling, though,
yeah,
or to narration.
I definitely draw a lot from poetry, and I envy poets. I've never written a poem in my life, really.
But you're a creative writing teacher. You tell students sort of creative writing 101. You got to have an arc. You got to have conflict. You got to have a protagonist and an antagonist, all that kind of stuff. And yet these are often just images, as you say.
Yeah, I think I tend not to be the kind of, you know, when I do talk to people about stories, I tend not to tell them what has to be in them or doesn't have to be in them. I tend to feel like stories can be coming from your own definition of what they are. So when you know, great stories, you know, Virginia Woolf's Kew Gardens, there's no characters in there. It's a place. It's a garden that is the story. And so,
well, the snail and a few others.
Right.
There are characters in there.
Absolutely. But not, they're not the main events.
Well, you take us into some rich storytelling, though, and some of it is about storytelling itself. For example, there's a story about this couple who talk about having been to the Coconut Grove and about an actor who is now sort of rendered to oblivion. And they have kind of embellished the story to a degree that it's become their story. They've owned it, even though it has nothing to do with what happened. They got out of there because of indigestion. So you said, what kind of story would, you know, Pepto-Bismol make or something like that? But it really tells us a lot about how people sometimes need to fill their lives with confabulating and fabricating, doesn't it?
I think, I mean, people have said this before me, but we define ourselves by the stories we tell. And I think in the case of the Coconut Grove story, this incredibly massive, horrific fire, almost 500 people died in that fire. And I had, it was an old family story of an uncle of mine who, according to my grandmother, claimed that he was in the Coconut Grove that night, and she always thought he was making it up. And I thought, why would anyone make up the fact that they'd been in a fire in 1946 or around thereabouts? And I thought, well, he was creating some kind of identity for himself by claiming to have been someplace that he hadn't. And I think that that's a way of getting someplace, you know. In a way, he was there. What makes the story sort of twist is that his wife also starts imagining that she was there, and her version of it is a lot more horrific, and that completely freaks him out. So I think, you know, I think part of that story is that stories are dangerous, so be careful if you tell them.
It's also interesting that the catalyst for the story was your own experience and your own sort of a question that was looming over your own personal history. The title story also brings us into sort of a story made out of a hurricane, and again, people take these disasters and they relate to them in ways that are quite personal and sometimes just fill in gaps that are there and that they need somehow to fill in.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of my stories, I think, come from stories that are repeated again and again in families. Why is that? Why, you know, we get together around a table and we, you know, the dinner table, and years will go, and we will tell the same stories. We're not telling it for plot. We know what happened. Why we in families retell stories is to somehow relive some intense experience. And I use my own family stories. So the title story, Last Car Over the Sagamore Bridge, is about my own grandfather and my mother trying to outrun the hurricane of 1938, and my grandfather retelling this story ad nauseum because it defined him in some ways. And I'm always looking and I'm always asking other people, what are the stories that you and your families tell and tell and tell and tell? Because I think there's something there that is incredibly significant in terms of defining who we think we are.
We may put that question out to listeners. You know, sure. When you think about family stories and what is told over and over again, if you can give us some shorthand versions of those, it'd be interesting to hear what those stories are. I was also struck by some of the autobiographical fragments here that appeared to be almost unadulterated autobiography. I mean, I assume a housekeeper did put you in an oven?
So I'm told. my parents came home one night and it was a cold night in Chicago. The heat went out in the building, and my parents came home and found me in the oven on warm. They always make sure to say that part, that I wasn't cooking, I was just on warm. But again, the truth of that has always been quite somewhat dubious, and so I use these kind of, you know, again, old saws. And I mean, in my house, if you tell that story again, people start to fall asleep. You know, they've heard it so many times, but, you know, for people who haven't encountered it, and it's just something I've carried around with me my whole life, this idea that, you know, one time I was put in the oven. But when the book has all these fragments in it throughout, and they're made to seem autobiographical. In some cases they are, in some cases they're not.
Well, you hear stories about things that happened to you when you were an infant or when you were a couple of years old, and they become almost encased in your memory, even though you probably have amnesia about that and don't remember it at all.
Completely.
Just a family story, really.
Become myth. They become our myths, our personal myths.
And talk about myths, I mean, and the kind of range in your storytelling here. I mean, when I opened this volume, little did I know I'd be reading about Geraldo and Nathan Leopold and Isaac Babel, not to mention dead people who are haunting us, who are the ghost of Harold Washington, no less. I mean, this is whatever spurs your imagination. It's there as a big canvas.
Yeah, the big I mean, I like to think of it as a big, small canvas. I'm constantly sort of collecting things. And, you know, when you work on a story collection over many years, as this took, I started to realize what my preoccupations were. And oftentimes they were people that sort of haunted my childhood. And then I thought, well, there's stories there. So Geraldo Rivera, that story has to do with Geraldo, a lot of your listeners will remember, discovered a supposed vault of Al Capone. And then he opened it on live television in Chicago that apparently went national. It was apparently a big moment in live television history. And of course, as people know, there was nothing in there but a wine bottle. And I was watching that as a kid, and I thought this was the most hilarious thing in the world. And I tried to reimagine it as an adult, which was a lot of fun to do.
But I don't know if you're working with this notion, but it occurred to me in reading, for example, about Harold Washington's ghost or mm-hmm. your Uncle Horace on a mission bus, you know, that the dead do visit us, as Sal Bellow said. And, you know, they do stay in our lives. I remember local writer Ishmael Reed, you know, mm-hmm. suddenly he'd be walking in the streets of Berkeley in his early work, like Yellow Radio broke down and Thomas Jefferson would appear. So, like, they're still with us, those characters out of history and myth in our own lives.
Yeah, how can they not be? You know, I mean, how can they, you know, they go physically, but how they don't leave our souls, they don't leave our brains, and it makes perfect sense to me that Ishmael Reed would encounter Thomas Jefferson on the street in Oakland. I think that you know, for me, it's weird if it doesn't happen. And I feel like we're surrounded by ghosts because we carry them with us. And, you know, Harold Washington, who was the mayor of Chicago, was an incredibly huge figure in my life as a young, you know, kid growing up in Chicago. He was this mythical figure. And then all of a sudden, you know, one day on Thanksgiving, he died. And we were so shocked. And I'm haunted by that to this day. And so I brought him back to Midway Airport.
What is it that haunts you about Harold Washington's death? Just the impact of this larger-than-life figure and his fact that he was mortal? Or
I think that and the fact that, you know, Chicago, you know, and again, gets into local Chicago politics, but he was the first African-American mayor of Chicago, the only. Eugene Sawyer was a mayor, interim mayor in between, but after he died. But Harold Washington was this incredibly charismatic, funny, brilliant politician, and he transformed the city in ways that I think we're still dealing with. And also, Chicago had a very difficult time with him. And what I've written about in other contexts, Chicago, which is a very Democratic city, had a Democratic nominee for mayor when Harold Washington won the Democratic nomination, which if you win the Democratic nomination in Chicago, you were automatically mayor. Not so fast in Chicago in 1983. What happened was a Republican came with inches of beating Harold Washington. Why? Because he was black. And it was an incredible upheaval in the city, which had to really kind of look at itself and just, you know, think about who it was. And Harold Washington forced people to look in the mirror. And I, you know, grateful for him for that. And, you know, there's a picture of Obama's office in University of Chicago when he was teaching, and he has got a campaign poster of Harold above his desk, and I've always admired that photograph.
Well, you know, in fact, the right wing often uses Chicago politics as a shorthand for what they don't like about Obama, as if, you know, he came out of this terribly corrupt and, you know, Blagojevich-ridden sort of world of Illinois. Have a story that won a Pushcart Award about a guy named Pemkin who was told by Dick Daley that he should run, and therefore he ran. And that was the way things were done. I mean, ward healers and all of that, it really truly was part of Chicago politics. Yeah?
And I grew up hearing these stories. My family was involved in the peripheries of politics, and I just loved hearing these stories, especially
about dead people voting.
Yeah, dead people voting, all that. You know, that's, which is, I think, fair. You know, dead people should have a voice too. You know?
Well, we were saying that so their memories are with us and so forth.
Exactly.
That was alleged and turned out to have some truth to it in the race between John Fitzgerald Kennedy and Richard Nixon.
Absolutely.
We're talking, by the way, with Peter Orner, whose new book is called Last Car Over the Sagamore Bridge, and he's the author of Love and Shame and Love, and we'll give you an opportunity to speak with him. I would be remiss if I didn't mention, I want to get back to your collection here, but the fact that you had a piece in the New York Times about living on Bernal Hill, and it was, again, one of these pieces that was really very telling in terms of how neighborhoods are changing in San Francisco. and how gentrification has really moved people out from the role of being neighbors. I use that word almost with a kind of sanctity to it, to being displaced. These are people in your neighborhood who couldn't afford to live to buy the house, and they were really good neighbors, and they had to move out.
Yeah, that piece was in response. There's a New York Times runs a column called Townies, which is usually a New York centered column, but they had asked me to write about San Francisco. And what had been on my mind that month when I was asked was the fact that my neighborhood was changing a great deal. Proceeda Park was changing a great deal. And in fact, one of my, you know, closest friends on the block were having to leave after trying to buy their house. These are teachers, and they just simply couldn't afford the exploding rents in Proceeda. And so I was sad about that, and so that's what I wrote about. And I happened to, at the time, been reading Howard's End, and when Forster talks about what he considers to be spiritual ownership versus title ownership. And it gave me a lot to think about in terms of, you know, yes, we may be people may be pushed out, and that is a horrible thing that you but I started to think about property and what it means to own literally versus own cosmically or something.
Or spiritually.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I mean, in fact, you felt in the neighborhood that these people were really the spiritual owners of this home, even though they were not indeed the owners of
the home.
It got
me in some trouble, but, you know, that's fine.
What kind of trouble?
Well, I think there was maybe people who thought that the piece was dividing owners and renters, and that was certainly not my intent. But I do feel like we need to have this discussion, and I'm not a city planner or anybody else other than a fiction writer. But when you feel like your neighborhood is changing and the city's changing, I think we got to speak up about it. But not that I offer a whole lot of solutions, other than we should at least talk about what's changing. I heard, I think, on earlier on NPR that 53%, the rents have increased by 53% or something along those lines.
It's becoming a very rich town, San Francisco, for wealthy people and all of its bohemian qualities. We talked about this, of course, on the air and recently had on people like David Talbot and Gary Camilla, who both feel fairly strongly about this sort of thing. Get back to your collection, though. Where do you come by writing about floor hockey in prison?
I in my previous life I went to law school and became a lawyer, which you know, there's so many lawyers who were unhappy being lawyers. I actually enjoyed law school because of the stories. I mean, it's I got a big kick out of watching people fight with each other, you know, on paper. I mean, like a will case, that's hilarious. People fighting over a will. I mean, it's not hilarious when you're the one fighting over it. But the floor hockey case that you ask about, I was doing some work in the in a Massachusetts prison, and I was representing a prisoner in a disciplinary hearing that involved an incident that happened on a floor during a floor hockey game in prison. And the Supreme Court of Massachusetts said that if you deprive somebody of liberty or deprive somebody of something, even in prison, you have to have some kind of legal process. It was a bit of a joke legal process because I represented a prisoner in front of a prison guard and had to argue his case in front of the very guards who were involved in the incident. So obviously I lost, but it gave me a story.
Well, and it's one of these stories about I don't want to give away any endings here, but it does have death in it. Somebody said there are a lot of corpses in this new collection of yours, and I think that's not an exaggeration. In fact,
that's fair.
There's a story about a divorce, and the guy dies after the divorce. And all I found you were very empathic from a woman's point of view. I mean, because she's divorced him, but she loses something with his death that she obviously is experiencing in a very profound way.
I think in that story, and I just in general, I mean, divorcing somebody doesn't mean that you don't carry them with you. And I think that in the case of that particular story, I was on the BART, and I wrote that story on the BART, and I actually missed my stop, and I went out to the end of the line in East Bay. But I think that divorce in that particular case, you know, he goes, and she didn't ever get a chance to say a proper goodbye. I think she says something like, "I just wanted to be alone, not alone, alone." And you know, I've tried to imagine what that might be like to sever your relationship with somebody and then have to deal with their actual almost taking you up on it.
Did you also work with a V-Hall guy?
Hey.
I think it was called V-Hall.
The V-Hall.
V-Hall, yeah, V-Hall.
Yeah, you know, I was
we should mention what this is,
right,
first of
sure.
all. Yeah.
I worked in the sewage department in my hometown after college. The year after college, I was a sewage worker, which basically I went around and kind of dealt with the sewage pump problems. And so that was based on some, you know, a lot of my stuff is like based
just
on fragments
something. Of your life.
Yeah,
really,
and then I sort of twist them around as most fiction writers do. I manipulate them and make stories out of them. But that involved a case that happened, an early school shooting that I listened to on the radio while I was in the sewage truck. And it was just a horrific time in Chicago's history, in America's history, that, you know, it was a time when a school shooting was more more surprising than it is now, unfortunately.
But the focus in the story is really on this strange guy that the protagonist is working with who
right.
You know, doesn't show much emotion about anything, including the school shooting.
Yeah, they're listening to the school shooting, and Larry doesn't react at all. And the narrator's trying to figure out how he could possibly not react to this. But in a way, maybe he was reacting, and that the guy just didn't get it. You know, that silence is as powerful as, you know, talking.
So you're still involved in a lot of social action type of stuff, human rights law. You're doing a book with Dave Eggers on Haiti?
For Voice of Witness, which is the nonprofit wing of McSweeney's. We're working on our oral history set in Port-au-Prince right now.
In fact, you did a book together, and I featured both of you here on Forum, which was about problems of undocumented.
Right, about immigration. Yeah, that was a few years ago. Yeah, that was a good.
Yeah. You miss law?
Only to the extent that I can't get in there and use it, you know. But I was going to be a terrible lawyer when I was planning on doing it. So I think the world is a lot better place that I'm not a criminal defense lawyer, which is what I wanted to do, because I think I would get too distracted by the people's stories rather than defending them. So I think the world should be grateful for that. But I do love it, and I do. I do love how law tries to solve problems in such an incredibly blunt way. And I think what stories do, and I think when I think about how they're contrasted, I think stories are much more subtle. But you gotta understand why law has to do what it has to do. It's got to be blunt. It has to be black and white in some ways, because it has to decide actual things. Stories
and
don't.
One needs rule of law.
Yes.
Yeah.
Billy Budd, right?
That's right. We're talking again with Peter Orner, and I'm going to actually put the question out to listeners. Are there stories that continue to occur in your family, stories that are told about your childhood or about experiences of your parents or loved ones or their friends or whatever? And how many of those stories, or if you think of a particular story, how true do you believe it is, or how true do you know it is? I'll put that out. We're talking about stories and storytelling with Peter Orner, and you may have a question for him just about the storytelling process, about his love of words, about human rights law, about so many subjects that are on, again, this wide canvas of his life. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. You may also want to say something about gentrification in San Francisco. Again, you can join us now at 866-733-6786 or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go right to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. And, of course, you're welcome to go to our Facebook page or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. But feel free to join the program. His new book, Last Car Over the Sagamore Bridge. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking with Peter Orner, who is the author of a new collection of fiction called Last Car Over the Sagamore Bridge, and is also associate professor of creative writing at San Francisco State. He'll be reading from his work and having a book party Thursday at 7 p.m. at the McRoskey Mattress Factory on Market Street. And on October 3rd, he'll be at Mrs. Dalloway's in Berkeley at 7 p.m. So you can meet the author. I was saying when we were off air that when you write using autobiographical material, as Peter does, I'm sure there are people in his life who are part of his family and circle of friends and so forth who see themselves in the work, but maybe even see themselves when they're not there. You ever get, you know, stung by people who or felt that they were stung? You get that sort of thing?
Yeah, that's definitely happened. I think more often than not, I've been lucky to have extremely good readers in my family who understand what it is that I do and know that I may be taking very liberally from things that they know very well and may have to do with their own lives, but know that I'm that this is my job. I mean, if I did, you know, if I was an electrician, I would do some, you know, this is these are the tools of the limited tools of my job, and that my family's been pretty gracious for the most part on that.
But you have come to storytelling in some respects out of a love for words, too. I mean, there's a piece that I read of yours where you talk about a guy reading a book and getting so close to the page that you felt that maybe he wanted to have some kind of intimate relationship with the text or the words themselves. I mean, do you feel that way when you read or when you write?
I think, you know, we've talked about teaching and things like that. I think the only way to do this is to read intensely and then, with hope, try and replicate that in your own work. The kind of if you can get a reader to read like that, and that's why I was curious about this guy. He was reading so intensely, and I don't think, you know, I hate to be, you know, when he's like, oh, in the old, you know, whatever. But I think people, I'm not seeing people reading as intensely. We're looking at our phones. That's not intense reading. You know, sometimes it is because people are reading novels on their phones, which is totally cool. But I feel like. I love it when I see that people are that engaged, and I want that.
Apropos of that, here's an email from a listener named Dan who says, in an age of Twitter and soundbites, do you think that short stories like yours can help bring our culture further back into an appreciation of literature? Well, it's a heavy question that fits on you.
I sometimes hear this that, you know, short stories should be so popular because of our low attention spans or whatever, and I had even had a friend kindly said that, you know, he had kept my book in his bathroom, you know, and that it was a perfect place for that, which I took as a compliment. I'll take what I can get. But I do feel I disagree pretty strongly that short stories somehow fit this attention deficit world that we're in. For me, a story like a poem takes incredibly intense concentration to engage with it. And so, yes, it's possible, but Twitter and all of that stuff for me doesn't necessarily help. It helps to slow down and read and you know, in the way that I think is you get the most out of it. So I'm not sure that it's going to help, or I don't sure it's even sure it's related to all these other things.
I did something a number of years ago for an organization probably many listeners know called The Teaching Company, and there was a number of lectures called Masterpieces of the Short Story, and somebody just told me that a friend of mine had listened to the tapes and said, I never realized that stories could be that transformative. That's kind of a difficult thing to convince people of, that stories can not only enhance your inner life, but that they can open up your life and be literally transformative.
I mean, for me, they're everything, and they always have been as long as I can remember. But I think there are a lot of people like that out there that maybe because of, you know, bad experiences in junior high or something in high school where, you know, Nathaniel Hawthorne was forced down someone's throat in a way that didn't teach him right, because Nathaniel Hawthorne is a god to me. He's so brilliant. You know, it's off the charts. But if you teach it as though it all fits together and is not mysterious, which is, I think, that maybe the key is that if reading becomes unmysterious, then we lose people.
We'll have a conversation one day about Hawthorne, you and I, off the air. In the meantime, listeners are welcome to join us.
Our toll-free
number. No, I also admire him enormously, but also have my contentiousness with him. Our toll-free number is 866-733-6786, and you can email us, forum@kqed.org. And I put the question out to listeners. Are there stories that you heard over and over again? And if you can give us kind of a good compressed version of one of those stories that particularly rises up to the surface, it'd be useful, interesting, maybe even transformative to hear. Let me get a caller on. That's you, Jack. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, guys. Hey, I'm a sales guy who wants to do some writing, and I've always wondered about you San Francisco writers. I mean, how do you make a living? I know Dave Eggers is doing some movie stuff, but, you know, this isn't the John Cheever, Truman Capote, Raymond Carver days. I mean, does anyone even read short stories? And just wondering, how can a writer make a living, especially if you're writing, you know, short stories and short fiction? Thanks.
Okay, thank you for the question. Good practical question. Peter, what do you say?
I think even in the days of Cheever, I'm not sure you could make a living writing short stories that well. It takes a great deal of time to write them. It takes a great deal of luck to get them published. So I think
Cheever drank up whatever he was exactly paid for the stories anyway.
So, I think being a writer has always been a tough way to make a living, and I wouldn't recommend it as a way to get rich. But, it is certainly, for me, I'm grateful that I can do it and can partly make a living from it. And you work hard and you get stuff out there and sometimes you'll get paid for it. But
you teach.
I teach.
And
yeah.
You have an associate professorship.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
That will, in effect, allow for you to indulge the luxury of writing stories.
Absolutely. But that said, you can, people sell books and certainly make a living from them. And we do, and that's still out there. And it's not, literature isn't dying. And I think that I wouldn't let the money issue stop you from giving it a shot.
Though the number of storytellers, fiction writers generally, novelists and so forth, who can make a living off of just writing, very small.
Very small.
And maybe even one could argue getting smaller.
But I would also argue probably always has been fairly small.
Yeah, no, that's true. Another caller joining us from Los Gatos. Susan, welcome. You're on the air with us. Hi. Susan, are you there?
Yes,
speak to us.
I was just sharing an old family story that had been told about my father-in-law for the last 25 years that I knew him. As a young man, he was born in 27. So maybe 37 to 40, somewhere in there, he was studying in his apartment in the Upper West Side of Manhattan on a warm fall evening. The windows were all open before air conditioners. And a neighbor lady loved to listen to her radio shows. So he built himself a radio jammer. And every time she would try and dial in the station, he would keep up with her, moving up and down the dial as she tried to find some form of entertainment.
This is sadistic behavior.
Well,
that's a funny story, though. But yeah,
he did go on to be an Eddie boy in the Navy, so obviously he had a propensity for engineering.
It could be useful in World War II, jamming signals and the like. That's a good story. Thank you, Susan.
It is a true story. Thank you.
Yeah, and
And I think it's interesting that story's kind of come to us from many decades later. And I also am interested in the term Eddie boy. That sounds great.
By the way, the links to the New York Times piece that I alluded to by Peter Orner and the forum interview that I did with Peter and Dave Eggers are up now on our website. And you, of course, can post anything you like there in the way of questions or comments, kqed.org/forum, or join us at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. Let's go to more of your calls. Clay, good morning.
Hi, Clay.
Clay, sorry.
Hi, I'm a San Francisco resident. I grew up in Colorado, and I'm the youngest of seven kids. My parents were big outdoors types, and there's a family story that's sort of become legend that's based in truth. And recently we were at a family reunion, and everyone was chiming in with their version. It goes like this. Schofield Pass is a pass in Colorado that goes up like 13,000 feet, and it's very treacherous for four-wheel drives to go over. I was there as a four-and-a-half-year-old with my older siblings, the oldest being 15, and our 21-year-old babysitter. And we were frolicking in a lake when a woman climbed up out of a ravine holding her arm in shock. And she said that their family had fallen, their car had crashed, and her husband and two sons were down at the bottom of this ravine. And when we were telling the story recently at the reunion, every one of my siblings had a different role in saving these people. My brothers were the ones who ran to get safety about a mile away. And then my oldest sisters, no, they were the ones who ran to get safety 2 miles away. And I had this memory of being taken down near the car crash, which I actually thought was total fabrication. And I actually learned just recently that my brother and sister, closest to me in age, have that very same memory. And to this day, we all have this fear of driving up steep hills. And it's a family legend that it was interesting to hear everyone's different perspective, that they sort of were the heroes or the victims. And, of course, my parents weren't there. They were on a rafting trip.
But fascinating. And, again, all that illustrative, Peter, wouldn't you say, of just how stories are Rorschachs anyway. But, I mean, you know, I went to a high school reunion and people were telling stories. No, that's not the way it happened. Right. You know, everybody had a different role, especially with things that are traumatic like that or that have a major impact.
And these, the idea of versions of the stories is what really interests me, because it, you know, you come at it from different angles and memory contorts and all of these things. But, you know, and people are making heroes out of themselves when they may not have been. That's what it's about. And I think the search for truth is a lot less interesting for me than the mutations that whatever did happen that day. One thing that seems to be maybe a common denominator in all those stories about that incident was this woman coming out of the woods. I love that idea. That's where, for me,
out of the ravine.
Yeah, and just coming up, and there, the whole family day changes. That, to me, you know, if I was working on that story, I might kind of cue in on that image. That woman, just a stranger, literally changing the course of this family's history.
Well, not only the changing of the day, but as you say, the history as well.
Yeah.
I'm reminded of a story my father told me about my grandfather in this vein. My grandfather was a big guy, and he was kind of a tough guy. And one day he saw two men beating up on a woman, and he couldn't abide it. And he went and grabbed both of them and pulled them away from this woman. And the woman pulled a knife out and gutted him. And I mean, because he was interfering with, you know, from her perspective, her personal business or whatever it was, you know. And of course, a story like that stays with you. Now, what you make of that story becomes kind of like a parable, you know.
Uh-huh.
I've always felt, you know, if you see something going on, you should act. I mean, it's a social citizen responsibility, but you could interpret that story almost the other way and say, you know, keep your distance.
It's an amazing story.
Well, but, you know, you have some amazing stories here. The one that I wondered about the genesis of particularly was, here's a guy in Covington, Kentucky, I mentioned before, one of the places. He's in a play, very amateur play, of Three Sisters, and he goes completely blank on his lines. Now, the genesis of that story? It's vivid. The story is vivid.
Yeah, it's a story that's been in my mind for years. It starts with a very basic premise. I mean, you know, I always remember being in high school in a high school play, and I just, you know, forgot my lines, as every amateur actor who's a bad actor in high school does. And I you know, it's weird how things kind of come together. But I was living in Cincinnati a number of years ago and teaching at Miami University and living in Cincinnati. And Cincinnati is right across the river from Covington, Kentucky. And I became really interested in Covington, Kentucky. And I would go back and forth to Covington. And just a few years ago, I remembered being in Covington. And then I put it together with a guy who forgets his lines in an amateur theatrical production. I mean, that's how weird these stories come together. It all makes sense to me. But of course, to anyone listening, what did I just say? But the genesis of a story like that really comes from this idea of not just forgetting your lines, but you're supposed to be who you are. And what happens if you can't handle that or you can't do it? And so this guy in this play is supposed to be this guy, Vershin in Three Sisters, is a wonderful character. He can't play him because he not only doesn't he know his lines, but he can't even kind of get into Vershin's soul. But he is Vershin. You know, it's a weird. It's, for me, it's a strange story.
You also bring light on the woman's response, too. I mean, you're very much with her in terms of, you know, she wants him to say those lines because
yeah.
This is very important to
and
her.
She's a bank teller in Cincinnati.
Right.
And so I was interested in the dual nature of actors being ordinary people outside of the stage at the same time they're on stage. And that, to me, it felt right, metaphorically right for what writers do in general, which is, you know, I'm pretending to be other people all the time. That's my job, to pretend to be other people. So I was wondering what it would be like to not be able to do it.
This is a former Ohio boy. I'm wondering why, yeah. When you were teaching at Oxford, did you live in Cincinnati?
You want to know? Oxford, because there were too many. It was too loud. There were too many fraternity houses in downtown Oxford. I hope I don't offend anybody from Oxford, but I had to get out of Oxford. With all respect to Miami of Ohio.
That's a great title. I had to get out of Oxford. Let me give another caller an opportunity. John, join us. Hi.
Hi. Hi. I got kind of an interesting story about Elvis Presley. Right. I was me and my buddy just got out of high school, Mission High School in San Francisco, and we joined the Marine Corps. And we had a couple of months to go before we left for boot camp, and we decided to make a road trip. We ended up in Las Vegas and lost all our money in the first bus stop before Las Vegas. So we got to Vegas broke. And we were hungry, so we went to a restaurant, and we ate and went out the back door. And that night, next door to the restaurant was the New Frontier Hotel where Elvis Presley was playing. We snuck in there to see the show and met a couple of chorus girls. And we're sitting at the table with Elvis Presley, and this chorus girl wanted to show me her new sports car. So I went out to the parking lot, and the waitress from the restaurant came into the New Frontier Hotel and spotted my buddy, called the cops, and they were going to arrest, you know, my buddy. And I saw this whole thing happening, but I stayed in the background. You know, my mother didn't raise any fools. So Elvis Presley came to the rescue. He went to the cops, told the cops he'd take care of all the damages, you know, whatever the bill was. You know, it was 1956, so it couldn't have been very much. And gave the waitress a $100 tip and told the owner of the New Frontier Hotel, who got involved in this thing, that he wanted him to take care of us. We were probably hungry. I mean, we were. Took us to a restaurant, bought a steak and spaghetti, and the best meal I ever had in my whole life, Elvis Presley. So I invited him to San Francisco to come to have dinner in my house. You know, my mother was an Italian cook, and she was terrific. And he never showed up. But
he missed a good meal, didn't he, John?
I write this story. You know, for years, when I got out of the Marine Corps, I went to State College and took creative writing. And this is one of the stories I wanted to tell, but I never could really get it out until recently. You know, I'm a lot older now. For some reason, and I don't know if your writer, you know, can identify with this, but I'm writing a lot better now since I turned 70 years old.
Well, you just told the story very well, by the way, and I think it's called maturity sometime as well as distance. So get it down on paper. In fact, it reminded me, you know, I never heard David Letterman laugh so hard when he had this guy on telling a story. Do you know that story? I think it went viral because a lot of these stories involve famous people like Elvis Presley. And this was a Lone Ranger was at a car dealership. The guy, Clayton Moore, who actually played the Lone Ranger. And they were going to take him, I guess, back to wherever he was going. And some guy knocked into their car, and they were hippies, and they were smoking marijuana, and they were kind of out of it. And he said, "You bumped into my car." And he said, "Who the hell is going to believe you?" You know. And then the Lone Ranger steps out of the car. And he's completely dressed like the Lone Ranger. You know? He says, "Citizen, I saw what happened here." Here's Owen, who writes, "My son is an attorney at the ACLU in New York. He's successful and directs the Criminal Reform Project. And he likes the feeling that he has a chance to influence policy at the federal level. But he's a naturally gifted writer and has a longing to write more than Supreme Court briefs. But his legal work devours all his time. I'm a writer and editor and have thoroughly enjoyed my career. So I'd like to encourage him to use his talent and his legal skills to make a change. Can your guest say what his age was when he made the change and how long it took to settle into writing as a profession?"
I was writing before law school, during law school, and after law school, so I may not be a great example. And I actually got a lot done in law school because I was so bored half the time that I was able to do a lot of fiction writing during class, I should say. But I also feel like we sometimes beat ourselves up, us people who want to write and do write, about how much time we have and don't have to write. You know, if you write 20 minutes a day, 15 minutes a day, you know, you can look at the Elvis Presley story. How long did that take to tell? So I think sometimes we almost talk ourselves out of creating when we certainly have time. And if we get off the internet, we'd have more time.
You got a critical email here. You okay to
sure
field that?
I can handle it.
Yeah. No, I mean, I almost have a policy of reading them. This says, "I'm listening about the guest Peter who got involved in a tenant's relationship with a San Francisco landlord. What idiotic hippie world do you live in that you can put someone on who obviously has no legal standing in the real estate transaction? I write tax books, and if you want to pay the mortgage and all the expenses and bear the additional cost of being a responsible party, then you are the landlord. He is a fuzzy-headed liberal who stirs up public sentiment into a commercial transaction, landlord-tenant, in which he has no right to participate. I bet both of you own real estate, have CPAs and lawyers who handle your assets. Why don't you allow competent persons to speak about the law instead of idiots like your guest?" They're actually damning both of us there with the full
right.
brush.
Right.
You want to say anything? I'll reserve my comments.
Sure. You know, I think that whenever you get into this area, you get this kind of response. And I think that it's how can it be a bad thing to say that people are getting priced out of this city and that we need to think about the consequences of that? In my own piece, and I was careful to say that I am no expert on any of this, but when neighborhoods change and when the characters of those neighborhoods change and when longtime neighbors have to leave, I think as a citizen and certainly as a writer, as a, somebody who uses my imagination to think about some other alternatives to that. And I was using in that particular piece I wrote in the Times talking about a novel that was written many, many years ago to relate to some of the things I was seeing on my own block. And, you know, if that's a crime, then I plead guilty.
Here's Sherita writes, my grandmother once told me that she thinks the portrait of Uncle Sam in the We Want You poster was drawn in the image of my grandfather's grandfather. We know it's not true because the details in her story change. What do you do with the stories in your family that evolve over time? There's a good rhetorical question to toss out.
It's a great question. I think embrace the evolving and let, stories that become embellished or in some cases, in my case, I often take a story that has been embellished and then I pare it back down, and then I move back to some element of it, like the woman coming out of, up from the ravine, or even, I'm more interested in the Elvis story when he's sitting at the table and what did Elvis order that night? That's what I want. You know what I mean? So I think that there are ways in which you can work with elements of stories or anecdotes or however you want to call them and then start to branch off using your imagination. And I always feel like people get hamstrung by the truth. And the fact is that in my business, in the fiction side of my life, I never let the truth get in the way.
Well, I remember Ken Kesey's line, sometimes it's the truth even if it never happened. But I also was reminded of something Amy Tan once said to me about, I think it was a Kitchen God's Wife, that it was all this dreadful treatment of a woman who was somewhat based on her mother by man that she was married to, man that she was with. And Amy said, I had to scale it back because it was much worse than even that. So there you have it. Let me get to Berkeley. And Irene, hi.
Hi. I have a quick story about today. I tuned in late and I was listening to your guest and I thought, gee, he sounds familiar. I bet it's Dave Eggers. I thought that was funny that he's affiliated.
It's a Chicago accent.
Yeah, anyway. Same freshness and unpretentious, inspirational type. Anyway, my grandparents were from Palestine, and my grandfather went ahead to New York. This was in the 1920s. He went ahead to New York to raise enough money to send for his wife and the rest of the kids. And when my grandma went to the boat with her three children, it turned out that she and her oldest daughter had conjunctivitis, and they wouldn't let them on the ship. So she had to let my 10-year-old mother and her 8-year-old little brother go alone on the ship all the way to New York from Palestine. Mm-hmm. And there a lot of stories came out of that whole period, the immigration saga of our
family. That story stays in the family. And thank you for that, Irene. And so many of those, I'm reminded of a young woman I went to high school with whose last name was Venig, and her actual name was Howard, but at Ellis Island, the story was they asked the grandfather, what's your name? And he thought they were asking him how much money he had. He said, 12 Pfennig. So the name became Pfennig. I mean, these stories are legion, just like stories about famous people.
Right.
Let's get Dan on. Dan, hi.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hey, two things. Today's my anniversary of moving to San Francisco from Butte, Montana, 33 years ago. I moved to Fillmore Street, and I can't tell you how much that neighborhood has changed, where we used to know all the old owners of stores on Fillmore Street is now all trendy boutiques in a different genre. So I'm looking to move on one of these days. But I'm also wrote my first novel. It's about Butte, Montana, and basically the family that founded Montana. It's kind of interesting that Ivan Doig just published a book about Butte, I think, a few days ago. So it's kind of an interesting subject. But in San Francisco, are there groups that young writers, or actually I'm an old writer, could meet with to talk about things like editing and story refinement?
I'm sure there are. There are a great many writers in San Francisco, and I know a lot of writers have writers' groups and things like that.
You mentioned the Grotto. They have classes there, for example.
They do have classes at the Grotto,
exactly.
Sure.
That, yeah.
Yeah,
and Grotto. Of course, you could take actually a class from Peter over at San Francisco State,
yeah, cool.
And continuing education courses. There are lots of opportunities to, and writers groups sometimes just, you know, form as bands on their own.
Absolutely, yeah. On your block, there are probably a writers group or a readers group or, you know, book clubs or things like that. San Francisco Legion of that. I'm interested in Butte, by the way. I met somebody the other night in Portland, Oregon, whose family grew up in Butte. It's fascinating. Talk about a place that's changed. So I'm interested in the Butte stories.
Yeah. Well, I hope you find something, Dan, and good luck to you. There's you're interested in a lot of these small towns, Ottumwa, Iowa, and Sheboygan, Wisconsin. Pubic, Illinois. That's a real name,
no,
Pubic, Illinois?
That one I might have made up.
Yeah, I think so.
Pubic, Illinois. But I am interested. My mother's from Fall River, Massachusetts, which is a town like Butte had a real heyday. I mean, Fall River, Massachusetts was the textile capital of the world in the 1860s, and they're still trying to recapture that glory. It's a rough town that my mother's from, and I've...
Is that why your mother... In fact, there's a kind of line in one of your stories where you say, my mother, Jimmy Carter, had met my mother, but, you know, in effect, you were suggesting that if he had, he would have been taken over by her.
He may have been taken by her, sure. She was very... She is a very wonderful person, Mom, if you're listening.
But her strength comes across in that line. I mean, just very formidable woman, yeah?
Absolutely, yeah, she is.
Peter, congratulations on your new collection, Last Car Over the Sagamore Bridge. Good to have you on Forum. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much, Michael.
And we are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. We'll be back on tomorrow. We're going to talk tomorrow about traumas of everyday life with Mark Epstein, who is a psychiatrist as well as a Buddhist. And... first hour, the plan is to talk about the 50-year anniversary, but really, to what extent have we moved forward in terms of race relations? Having that conversation about race, very important. I want to thank our senior editor, Dan Zoll, our producers, Judy Campbell, and Irene Noguchi. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai. Thanks again to Tina Larberg, and I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and the Bernard Osher Foundation, supporting higher education and the arts.